Hello and welcome back to Heights Libraries Podcast, Unpacking 1619, where you can explore the interviews we've collected with scholars from around the country, in which we unpack topics relating to race in America. I'm your host, John Pichet, and I'm thrilled to share these interviews with you here. On this episode, we are joined by University of North Carolina at Charlotte's Kelsey Klotz. Professor Klotz and I discuss her new book, Dave Brubeck and the Performance of Whiteness. In it, she examines how Dave Brubeck used his fame to challenge segregation in the South. Here's our conversation from January 12, 2021.
My name is Kelsey Klotz. I'm a lecturer in the Department of Music at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. My research focuses on Dave Brubeck. I'm currently writing a book through Oxford University Press called Dave Brubeck and the Performance of Whiteness that's using Dave Brubeck as kind of a focal point to understand what whiteness meant at mid-century. So not only what it meant for him as he created his music and operated in his career, but also what it meant for jazz critics who were predominantly white at the time to talk about him, and also for his audiences, what whiteness had, what role it had to play in their enjoyment of his music and in their kind of entry point, using him as an entry point into the broader world of jazz.
Excellent. Thank you. So the one thing that I would like to begin with is, and we'll talk first about Dave Brubeck, I think, where he had an integrated band and he was doing a college tour, which I guess, how common was that for jazz musicians at the time?
Doing college tours was pretty common beginning in around the 1950s. And Dave Brubeck really was one of the first to start doing this. His wife, Iola, they needed gigs. And so his wife, Iola, wrote to different colleges around California that were within driving distance and asked, do you want a jazz group to play? His group at that point was mostly and usually white. Sometimes there was a black bassist who would join in here and there, but it was usually white. And so in the 50s, that's really how Brubeck builds his brand, is as a college touring musician. And he takes some credit for getting other jazz groups, and particularly getting black jazz groups like the Modern Jazz Quartet into similar college tours as well. Within the South, though, I think you get, you still have some college tours, but they have some different rules that are that are needed to follow.
Yes, and that was, I mean, again, we're talking about what, 1957 to 59, that area, that era? So the colleges, and I guess UGA, University of Georgia, changed their policy based on him.
East Carolina University, that was East Carolina College then, now it's East Carolina University. Yeah, he came with Eugene Wright in 1958 to East Carolina College. They didn't know that he had an integrated quartet. He had actually just integrated it. They told him that he couldn't perform. He said, that's ridiculous. I'm not going to perform without my black bassist. And it was something that was escalated to the North Carolina governor. And the governor, essentially what the reports are, the North Carolina governor essentially said, well, did you already pay him? And they said, yes, we've already paid him. And that kind of got him, the school officials were kind of like, okay, I guess the governor is not going to fight this. We'll let you play. And then afterwards, they made it so that integrated ensembles could essentially perform at East Carolina College.
And this is the, if I'm correct, this is the quote that I wanted to kind of pick out, which was accepting the skill of the Negro performer and even going so far as appreciating it as a giant step towards integration. And we cannot afford to be the least bit broad-minded, not even for the sake of art. That was their...
That was a student at UGA, which happened in 1959, so a year later. Okay. He tries again to take his quartet into the South. He's invited by the Jazz Society of UGA, which was new. It was brand new. Again, they thought that he was an all-white quartet, and they sent the promotional materials and learned that he was not an all-white quartet. And that was, it blew up in the editorials, and that was in an editorial written by a student in such hyperbolic language that it almost seems like a parody of themselves. And that one was one where he did not succeed, and he was not allowed to perform.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that Brubeck wasn't allowed to perform based on the, yeah.
Right, yeah, they revoked the invitation. The student who led the Jazz Society did kind of try to keep it, but there is only so much that this student could do in the face of the university officials telling him, and state officials as well, saying that integrated groups could not perform. They could have all white groups, they could have all black groups, they could not have integrated ensembles.
Yeah, that's incredible. And then I think tying that idea, especially in the South, to the Morris article, which we'll be discussing, Why Is Everyone Stealing Black Music? And kind of the white rage, white fear of black performers, you know, and in the minstrel shows, having white people perform as black people, and then eventually black people having to put on darker makeup to perform. How do you see that development as it moves into?
Yeah, I think that in the article, he spends so much time with blackface minstrelsy, which is so important. Because I think there's not enough space given to that as really America's first popular musical form in so many different ways. But I see what I would bring into the conversation is Eric Lott's conversation of love and theft. So Eric Lott writes about blackface minstrelsy, and he sees this, it's fear. But there is some, it's fear is kind of hard to take out of the love. There is this interest and intrigue in this other, which white people have created as an other. And so there is that kind of interest and blackface, the kind of putting makeup on, creates a distance. And so it creates that ability to make sure that love doesn't overcome the white actor for the audience's presence, so that they can still kind of point and laugh and enjoy it without having to come too close to, you know, love of black people, without having to come too close to miscegenation and all of these things. I think what we're seeing, particularly as we move through the Jim Crow era and as white people and black people are kind of rubbing up against each other in more ways, we see that distance kind of going away. And that's something that is so uncomfortable for white Americans, white Southerners, yes, but across the country, that they don't have that way of distancing anymore. And so what Carol Anderson writes when she writes about white rage is about, I see kind of a connection between that minstrelsy and between this moment in the 1950s, where you start seeing these images of white people protesting integration in various locations, that we see this just utter fear of those separations coming down, and it manifests in rage at this time.
And the mean, it's interesting too, because the, as we were talking before the interview, the minstrelsy allowed white people to translate black songs and dialect and jokes and culture and all that kind of stuff through a white lens, which I think is what you were talking about with this, like, we love to laugh at and see, but at the same time, we don't want to celebrate at this point in history. And
yeah, I think there's a quote in there, sorry to interrupt, there's a quote in there that really stays with me, that Morris writes, loving black culture has never meant loving black people too. And I think that is an important point to kind of come back to at that, as in what, in relation to what you're talking about.
But at the same time, we have, you know, as it moves out of white blackface, then black culture becomes more authentic than white culture, or white translation of black culture. Maybe you can kind of unpack that for us if you can.
Yeah, well, I'll try. It's a big question. And it's one that I'm not sure has a clear answer. So there are, I'll probably just talk in circles around it to try to just give some different kind of entry points into it. In terms of kind of thinking about authenticity and race and music, I'm going to pull it into jazz for a minute because that's just my wheelhouse. But when we're thinking about authenticity, jazz starts as a black music. It is a black music. And when I say that, I'm not necessarily defining it in terms of particular musical features that are black. I'm not kind of making that definition. I'm saying that it was created by black people, and it was largely kind of perpetuated and moved through black culture. It was important, and it opened a lot of opportunities within black culture. And so around that came a kind of a discourse, a way of talking about jazz music in terms of authenticity, of like, what is real jazz and what is not real jazz. And so a lot of what real jazz is came to be defined in terms of blackness. And this is where it gets into the really complicated part, where, again, I want to just reiterate, because I get this question all the time, so it's okay, but I am not the one defining what blackness means in jazz. What jazz scholars like I have done have kind of gone back through the history and seen, okay, this is what jazz critics and jazz musicians are saying. This is how they're talking about it. And in that, they're creating these definitions around blackness. And so that has to do with, it has to do with swing, and it has to do with improvisation, like Morris mentions. And this becomes a language where in jazz, where it's this unique form where blackness is actually upheld as truth and as reality and as authenticity. And it is used to kind of say, like, well, if you can perform like a black musician and do these kinds of things, then you are also an authentic musician. And so you get someone like Brubeck, who he is insisting that he is doing those things. There are some people who agree that he's doing those things, but then there are all of these other people who are saying, well, no, you're just too popular. You are not doing these musical things. And so they've created this kind of musical definition based on race, which, as we know, though it is a lived experience, it is also a constructed experience. And so when we are also talking about musical definitions of race, those are also constructed as well. So when we're using race to define authenticity, we're looking through and kind of peeling back layers of, okay, how did that authenticity get embedded within race and racial discourse in these different time periods? I hope that
Yeah, it makes sense. And it's just an interesting shift from like what we were talking about a minute ago with like the minstrel shows, where we wanted, the purpose of it was to have inauthentic experiences. And then by 80 years later or something, you have a shift to, you know, the cool or authentic music has to be African-American or Black. And that, I think that has a lot to do with, I mean, I don't know what it has to do with, but it seems like your one article talked about how Miles Davis did a Brubeck song and kind of made it okay for it, like validated Brubeck mm-hmm. by covering his song. And, you know, that's just an interesting shift. And I don't know if it's the artists who did it. I think it's the artists who did it and not the society itself, the fans, I guess.
I think that one kind of key, when we're moving from talking about Black bass minstrelsy to talking about jazz, like one thing to keep in mind is that with Black bass minstrelsy, this is almost entirely created by white people for white people. And it is, there is this kind of obvious veneer of inauthenticity, but the white people who are viewing it, especially for Northern white audiences, Blackface Minstrelsy was more popular among Northern white audiences than it was around Southern white audiences, in large part because Northern white audiences didn't actually have any experience or very much experience with Black people. So for them, it was this kind of authentic representation of Blackness. And that's what made it so dangerous, particularly leading into the Civil War. So I think with Blackface, you have, it's created predominantly by white people for white people. You do have Black musicians who are kind of forced to take on the mantle of Blackface because that's it. If you want to be a performer, that's all there is. But then when we get to jazz, with jazz music, and especially by the 1950s, it's not entirely popular music anymore. So it is created by Black and white musicians for Black and white audiences, but it is seen as like this pseudo subversive thing. It's not like, it is not always truly subversive, but there is this non-mainstream feel. That is not the case with Dave Brubeck, but with other artists within jazz. So in having that language of authenticity around jazz, what they're really kind of doing is setting themselves apart from mainstream culture. Whereas with Blackface, that it was mainstream culture. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good explanation. I think I don't know if you want to try, or we can try to, like, in the introduction to your book, the various ways in which kind of white supremacy and filters into music. And one of the things that was most interesting to me, because I hadn't heard about it, was this idea of the white audio ology, did you call it, or something, where it has to sound white. So like Nat King Cole, I think, is brought up by Morris as he was allowed to be on the radio because he sounded white enough. And then when they put him on TV, he was too Black to be on TV. So what does that mean to sound white artistically? I mean, I know that there's a more thing societally, you know, but the music.
Yeah, that's a good question. So before we started recording, you brought up that Amiri Baraka quote. And Amiri Baraka is talking about and kind of comparing Charlie Parker with Paul Desmond. Charlie Parker is Black, Paul Desmond's white. And they're both saxophone players operating in the late 1940s into the 1950s. And what Amiri Baraka is saying is that, well, when you hear Charlie Parker, all the critics call him primitive or raucous. And when you hear Paul Desmond, everybody calls him classical or pure. They sound, that's how they call his sound. And so I think a lot of it has to do with music is hard. It's just hard to talk about. If you don't have a lot of training, if you don't have the analytical stuff to do that. And so what you have are a lot of critics who aren't necessarily trained to talk about music, writing for audiences who also aren't necessarily trained to hear an analytical description of music. And so you get adjectives. Adjectives are great. I work with my students in 100 level classes to kind of hone how they use adjectives to describe music, but adjectives are particularly susceptible to cultural connotation. So when Amiri Baraka is talking about how critics write about the difference between Charlie Parker and Paul Desmond, it's not only that they describe Charlie Parker in primitive terms, it's what does primitive mean? Primitive means that Charlie Parker is not intellectual. It means that he hasn't carefully honed his sound to sound that way. Sorry. It means that he hasn't thought through things or practiced. And all of that, if you know anything about Charlie Parker, is totally untrue. He worked incredibly hard. He practiced. He knew exactly what he was doing by that point in the 40s and into the early 50s. And by calling Paul Desmond pure, by calling his sound pure, I mean, that's a super racially charged term, especially in the 50s. That in essence is kind of saying without saying, this is a white saxophonist. The word that I use that I kind of go through and dissect that gets used to describe Dave Brubeck a lot is intellectual. So critics just across the board are calling him, they say he has an intellectual sound. And so I kind of try to work through, okay, what does that mean? Who else is getting called intellectual? And it's really within jazz, pretty much it is used, intellectual is used to describe cool jazz musicians. Cool jazz is a particular subgenre of jazz that is predominantly associated with whiteness. And what I found as I was kind of going through the work and how people were talking about Dave Brubeck was that when they're talking about intellectual, they're not just saying it sounds like he thought about stuff. They're linking him to Western classical composers. They're linking him to, it's Gershwin and it's Mio, but also they link him to Beethoven. Bach gets mentioned the most out of any composer to compare to Dave Brubeck. And that's not something that gets thrown around nearly as frequently with other Black musicians, notably someone like John Lewis of the Modern Jazz Quartet, who composes fugues and things in a jazz style. That's just not something that happens for John Lewis in the same manner that it does for Dave Brubeck, who also composes but isn't doing the kind of strict fugues that John Lewis is doing. So kind of looking through and asking, okay, they've used this word intellectual, how are they using it? Okay, they're also using it with these other composers. Okay, when they use these other composers, they're talking about counterpoint and fugues. Okay, and kind of going through all of these things that these critics are linking. And so by doing that, the critics are embedding Dave Brubeck within a sound of whiteness, particularly through classical music, which at that point is seen as predominantly a white musical genre.
Right, and that's... So, I mean, I guess the it's less a actual thing and more an actual, like, critics assigning the code to it. So that's, yeah.
Right, yeah. There isn't just a kind of blank slate white sound necessarily. It's what we have come to understand as a white sound, which for the critics was classical music at that point. And the idea of kind of pure sounds that Amiri Baraka brings up and Morris talks about as well. I think he uses that word too. That is something that kind of stays in, and I think you can see, if not the word pure, a lot of similarities in descriptions that can embed musicians within this concept of what a white sound might be.
Yeah, and on a kind of on an unrelated note, I'm always hit by the word primitivist because it takes me back to the degenerative art that was, the Weimar Republic and how the Nazis came in and kind of deemed mainly Jewish and other outsider art, people they didn't like, as primitivist and degenerative, and it's quite a loaded term, I think, culturally and historically. So it's not just like, oh, these people sound like primitives. It's also this like dismissive like cutoff for at least, I mean, that's how I read it, but I also have loaded things in my head too. So that music then takes on a whole other set of problems. I mean, we've been talking about jazz and classical and I mean, like the Elvis Presleys and the Beastie Boys and the M&Ms taking over these forms is even more complicated or differently complicated. How would you kind of?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting and you're right, definitely complicated. When I think of someone like Eminem, he is someone who by and large has been kind of accepted as like, yeah, you can do this. This, what you do and the way that you do it is, if we're going to kind of go back to this idea of authenticity, it is authentic. And he has kind of in some ways earned that, not being a rap and hip hop scholar. I don't know the details quite as well. Other than that, I think he kind of, I keep struggling with the word earned, but it seems like he earned it through like a similar class experience. And so there is this kind of other avenue that he took, and by and large, it didn't, he has helped other Black musicians, and he has been a platform for them in ways that other white musicians that haven't really been doing in that genre. So I think of someone else like Macklemore, sort of more recent, who is someone who I think got a lot of criticism for not being authentic. And in that term, what they're saying when they're saying that he's not authentic is that this is another Black musical form, rap and hip hop, and that is, you know, fairly clear from, again, a historical perspective and then through its lineage, that, and the fact that it, like jazz, is based in kind of Black experiences. And I think a lot of people were looking at Macklemore and kind of going, okay, where are your experiences, and how does that play out, and then kind of linking Macklemore to someone like, or to a group like the Beastie Boys, and also to Dave Brubeck, the popularity that you've gotten feels unearned because of that. Mm-hmm. So you have Black musicians who are not getting this coverage and who are not getting this platform. And so I keep coming back to earned, and I hadn't thought of it in this way before, but that there is this level of kind of earning that authenticity that feels entirely unearned if you kind of just come along and are within the genre, and then are kind of scooping up awards and recognition and chart placements.
I mean, it also struck me while we were talking about Eminem that, you know, his myth creation happened very quickly. Like 8 Mile came out and it took, 30 years for the NWA movie to come out. You know, so it's like he was able to, and Vanilla Ice had the same thing. He made a movie right away. So there's like opportunities for, I mean, that's completely, completely off topic, but I mean, it's kind of like the white performer got to kind of justify their earning the status, whereas with the black performers like NWA, they had to kind of, it was assumed that they were authentic and actually gangsters and doing the things that they said.
Yeah, I think that there's, when it comes to that unearned, whether it's Dave Brubeck or Vanilla Ice or whoever, I think that, and Eminem falls in this too, that they are for the white audiences that were kind of driving the market share of music, there is a comfort with them, and it's because they're white. There's really no use mincing reasons. Brubeck, I'm sorry to always take it back to him, but Brubeck was just more comfortable. He was featured in ads in Vogue and in Good Housekeeping and Woman's Home Companion. They talked about him. And they talked about him in ways that said, look, jazz used to be the dirty boy or the boy with dirty hands who you wouldn't let come into the house. And now it's okay. That's a discussion as you get. That one was either Woman's Home, I think it was Woman's Home Companion, but it was in this magazine targeting kind of middle-class white women. And suddenly there are middle-class white women who are listening to jazz because of Dave Brubeck. And he takes a lot of credit for that and says, I got them in the door and then they got to go and experience other musicians. And it creates this respectability aura around jazz. And, you know, Benny Goodman does this a couple decades earlier. Benny Goodman's an all-white swing band in the 1930s. He has black arrangers who are creating his music. He also has a black quartet that he performs with in between sets of his orchestra. And so he is another one where he is kind of creating this comfort level and this respectability around a genre that was not considered to be respectable. So I see that similarly happening with white musicians and with rap and hip hop, that there is a comfort, if not a respect, if respectability doesn't operate in the same way, there's at least a comfort level with them. And it's based in race and what white audiences are comfortable with and why they're comfortable with those musicians. And then it's also about predominantly white record executives who recognize that. And so it's about this kind of broader network of the industry. It's not just about the musicians, it's about the full industry, which includes producers and executives and booking agents and audiences as well.
And I think that's been one of my interesting kind of things that I've continually returned to, because like bands like, I'm going to go way off the field here, but like the John Fogerty Clearwater Revival, you know, allowed for kind of a folk music to enter into rock, but these are all like suburban or city dwellers from San Francisco. They're not bayou, you know, people playing authentic or what would be called authentic music. So, it was marketable and able to be kind of, you know, and then the people who wanted to explore, the fans could go deeper. but the money was being made up here with, you know, with the,
yeah,
with the, whatever it is, the market, you know, the package. But, and that's kind of what my big problem with Hamilton has always been, you know, it allows theater kids to enjoy rap,
mm-hmm.
because they're not going, you know, that it brings rap into a new market, basically, which is good, but at the same time, problematic, right?
Right. Yeah. It's both. It is both. Like there is some credit to be given to people like Benny Goodman and Dave Brubeck for getting kind of hooking people. And if they are able to then go explore the broader genre beyond the one artist that they came for, there is something to be said about that, but not everything. Right. Like we can't stop there. There is room for some critique, and some of that deserves to be put on people like Dave Brubeck and on Elvis and on these artists, white artists. Yeah. But it is also, it is to a certain extent beyond them as well. And to people whose names we don't know, like we don't know the producers necessarily. Rap and hip hop changed that a little bit, but we don't necessarily know the producers. We don't necessarily know the record companies involved. But when we have a musician, we have that face that we know very well. So yeah, there's a lot of room for critiquing, and there's a lot of people to place that critique on. But yeah,
we could go on and on, but I think this is probably a good place to stop, unless you had any other points you wanted to make directly.
I think one thing did come to my brain as we were talking about respectability, and I did just want to draw that tie into the Morris article talking about Motown and Black respectability. And I think that's a place where Black respectability is, again, another one of those things that is sometimes contentious to think about, but it does get kind of mobilized and operationalized in really important ways, like with Motown, to get Black musicians a place. Duke Ellington is another person that would be in a similar boat sometimes, not all the time, but that kind of operates in that kind of realm of respectability. And so it is a thing where a lot of people kind of critique Black respectability politics, but there is kind of a political subversive thing that's happening even in that, that I think deserves to get some recognition. And there's a scholar who's worked on that, that's Evelyn Higgins-Botham, that has worked through that. And I just wanted to shout that out, since I raised respectability in a white context. I just wanted to, yeah. Right.
Thanks for listening to Unpacking 1619. For more information on Heights Library 1619 Project Discussion Group, or to check out more interviews with scholars, please visit heightslibrary.org. See you next episode, wherever you listen to podcasts.